Golf Smarter, number 283, published on May 17, 2011, is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter.
SmarterPodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.
Chasing Greatness, the legendary U.S. Open at Oakmont in 73.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
We have a couple of guests today, and before I introduce them to you, I just wanted you to be aware that I know now that this is going to be a two-part conversation. Usually I don't tease that until we get a sense that there's so much more to cover. But once I started to read the book, Chasing Greatness, Johnny Miller, Arnold Palmer, and the Miracle at Oakmont, I found the story so interesting, so compelling, that there was just no way that we can do it justice in only 30 minutes. So be forewarned that part two is a members-only episode and will definitely be 30 minutes, but could easily be an hour long or even longer. And the only way you'll be able to hear part two and have complete access to our archives is by joining Golf Smarter for members only at golfsmarter.com. So now let me introduce you to the two authors of Chasing Greatness, Adam Lazarus and Steve Schlossman. Adam, welcome to the Golf Smarter podcast.
How you doing, Fred? Good to be here.
Thank you so much. And Steve, I'm so glad that you came to the Golf Smarter podcast and agreed to do this format. And, you know, usually what I do with a book is I'll review the book, I'll look through it, and then I'll ask a lot of questions about it. But this story got me so excited that I just decided that what I wanted to do is let the two of you tell the story and the history of it. But first, how did the two of you get together?
Well, it's an unusual circumstance. I'm a professor of history at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. And in 2005, I decided to teach a course on the history of golf. I've been thinking about it for a decade, and I got permission to do so. And I later learned it was the first and only course on the history of golf taught in any university in the U.S. or anywhere in the world, apparently.
Amazing.
And on the second time around in teaching the course, Adam, who was studying at the graduate level, in the English department at Carnegie Mellon, decided to take the course. He proved to be an avid student, to say the least, was teaching me as much as I was teaching him. And at the end of the course, I talked to him about this book I was conceiving and whether he might be interested in joining me. And he said, yes. And we thought we could combine my more traditional academic approach, real research-oriented, fact-oriented, very concerned about accuracy. And Adam had a kind of a sports writing style, aspires to be, and has now become a well-known sports journalist, and has a certain pizzazz in his storytelling that adds a huge dimension to our book. So we came together through a course, and he was 24 years old. I was 59 years old. It was an unusual joining together, but we spent 2 years banging heads working on this book, and it was a real joy to do.
Adam, I just can't believe that when he proposed that you work on this together, you just went, yes. I got to imagine it was more like, yeah, sure, right.
Well, I was just finishing grad school at the time, and I had to decide between an actual job. I had a job offer somewhere and this. And, I grew up reading the only thing that I would read, and that includes all the works of fiction I had in high school and college, was sports nonfiction. So when this came about and I thought about it and we discussed what we wanted to do, it was sort of like a chance to do something that I had always wanted to do and that was sort of near and dear to my heart. So I jumped on it. I took sort of a risk because we didn't have any kind of guarantees about a publisher or anything like that at the time. But it was such an interesting topic and such a sort of a rich history of the course and the tournament and everything, that it was kind of too hard to pass up.
And how difficult was it to get past the student-teacher relationship and become collaborators?
I think it was at first it was hard. I kind of felt like...
Was he writing red marks all over your papers?
No. I kind of felt like Steve was Doc Brown and I was Marty McFly from Black Panther. That's how I felt for a while. He probably learned some things from me, but I learned just how to be a real historian about things and get facts right. And there's a lot of things out there that the factual element is a little questionable. But Steve and I, and I've done this since on my other projects, that it's telling the history is important, telling it as it was, not as it may have been or as you would have liked it to have been.
Yeah, Steve, that's one of the things you wanted to make sure happen is that you gave a historical perspective on it instead of doing a lot of creative license.
Well, we wanted to have a book that was creative, as historians are creative, in their identification of unusual source materials and telling a real interesting story that might sometimes even be novelistic. But we really wanted it to be grounded in facts that could be verified in one way or another. They could start with documents. They could start with newspaper footage, articles. They could start with video footage. They could start with interviews. But we wanted to double check every source against every other source. And then for Haddam and I to come together and say, do we really know this? And to say, do we really know this 10,000 times over so that we can convince each other on every point. So yeah, I brought that maybe more conventional academic concern for getting it right to the project. And with this particular U.S. Open 1973, that turned out to be a number of iffy kinds of stories about the past, some of which contradicted each other. And so we knew both couldn't be right. So we had a lot of detective work to do and balancing of things. And a fair number of times when we said, we just don't understand if we know this, we'd have to come up with brand new sources to go after the truth.
Yeah, the thing that I would say about that also is, you do a book or any kind of work, even like a magazine article or anything, about something that happened a few decades ago, it's always great to go to the people who are involved today. If you want to do a book on or an article about, Willie Mays or someone, and you go ask him today about something that happened 50 years ago, the story is going to have changed over time. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But when you go back to those newspapers from the day or the week that it happened, you get quotes or details that may not surface 50 years later. So that was really, I think, the best byproduct of doing this kind of background work, was we came across things that either people have forgotten over time or got garbled over time. And that was especially quotes. It was really the quotes, but facts too. But, you got into the mindset of Arnold Palmer in 1973, not necessarily Arnold Palmer in 2010, which was, I think, in some ways that's better. So
interesting.
Yeah, we love doing interviews. We did 62 interviews, not just with players, but caddies, former Oakmont members, USGA officials, lots of people. And oral history is just a vital kind of thing to include in any historical portrait of a great single event. But you can't rely oftentimes on the factual recall of people, even if they were there nearly four decades later. Nobody can do it. And so it's really important to double check people's memories against documents from the time. And, often enough, we found out that the documents told a more reliable story than people's memories of them 40 years later. And so we'd blend what we knew for sure from interviews with what we had to challenge from documents.
Well, I can definitely relate to loving to do interviews, since this is episode number 283. I know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean. So when I started reading the book and I received it from your publicist, I was not all that familiar. I mean, I've talked many times in the show how I actually just started playing golf about 10, 15 years ago, closer to 15 years now. And I've always been a big sports fan, but my family weren't golfers, so I never really followed golf. I'd never really got it. And as soon as I started reading the book, you start to give an account of the golf course before you even get into the tournament. And all of a sudden, I realized you had multiple layers of stories here that It wasn't even worth asking questions. That I just wanted you to tell this story, and I found it so interesting that you started with the golf course.
Well, you know, this project began with my early experience with Oakmont. I won't go into all the details of it, but I'd come to know the course well in the 1990s, and I'd come to compare it with one of the other great tough golf courses in the U.S., the Black Course at Bethpage State Park in New York with the 2002 U.S. Open.
Better known as Bethpage Black.
Bethpage Black.
Yeah.
I got the date right of that tournament. But at any rate, Oakmont was always going to be a character in the story for us. We thought it was such a great course that there was nothing like it. And initially, in fact, we hadn't even decided upon 1973 as the date we'd zero in on. Hmm. But so we knew that Oakmont reputation for toughness and its development of the in the early 20th century would be part of the story. Ultimately, it became maybe a smaller part of the story, the history of the course itself, than we initially planned. But we wanted it in there really as our seventh big character. We have the six top finishers, and Oakmont's our seventh big character. And, you know, we're delighted that you responded to the course itself, because you can't conceive Oakmont of Johnny Miller, 63, having such a long-term reputation if it hadn't been shot on the very course that was known as the toughest in the U.S.
And had multiple opens and major tournaments that are historic in themselves.
More than any other, more major championships than any other course in the U.S.
Amazing. Yeah, one of the things that I think was sort of drove part of the storytelling was who had played there and who had won or almost won, because you know, the first major tournament there was in 1919 was the U.S. Amateur, and Bobby Jones had a big, that was when Bobby Jones was getting started, and then the first Open is in 27, and Jones is there, and Tommy Armour wins, who's, you know, one of the well known players of that era. And then the next Open is in 35, and you have one of the great, you know, dark horse, underdog, you know, out of nowhere winners in Sam Parks. So that was – those two early winners were interesting. And then you skip ahead, and there was also PGAs, but, you know, we're so mostly interested in the Opens because that's a tournament in my eyes at least. And then you skip ahead, and you have Hogan winning in 53, capping – in the middle of one of the greatest golf years, probably the greatest golf year of all time in 53. And then you skip ahead to the next time they host the Open. It's Palmer versus Nicklaus in the famous duel. So, and then the next one is the story we do. But, you know, you look at the progression from time to time, from the time of its first tournament, first major international golf tournament, to the time of where we start in 73. And it reads like a list of the Hall of Famers that, you know, in the greats of the game. So that's sort of what brought our attention to the course as much as anything else.
All right. So before we, and let's start with the six main players, but before we go there, I want to thank you again for creating a lesson plan for me, Steve. I mean, you did a beautiful amount of preparation for me, saying how you'd like to approach this. And again, I don't usually do it that way. It's a usually free-form conversation, and it will continue to be. But I appreciate that you laying out so that we can do these multiple episodes, which was, you know, I said, let's do as long as we can, and that you agreed to do it, but you laid it out this way. But before we get to that, because you're you're a writer, history, and sports, I want to say that this episode of the Golf Smarter podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature that feature audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. And hopefully this book will be there at some point as well. But for the Golf Smarter listeners who have yet to give Audible a try, Audible would like to give you a free audiobook of your choice so that you can hear for yourself how great the experience of reading an audiobook can be. With this offer, if you go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter and choose any audiobook from their vast library of 75,000 titles, you can pick one for yourself. And Steve, I'd like to throw it out to you. Sports, history, audiobooks. What would be our assignment, Professor?
Well, I've got several favorites I could choose from, but the one I'd like to recommend to your audience is one that we use to help frame the kind of book that we ultimately wrote in Chasing Greatness. And that was Laura Hillebrand's book, Seabiscuit, which is now known, of course, as a movie as well, but which is great in audiobook form.
Fabulous idea.
Kenyon College alum, which is where I went to school, too. So,
is that right?
Yeah.
And you read it as well?
Yes.
Well, you both should go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter and check it out for yourself. Do the audiobook so that while you're doing something else, you can continue to listen. Love audio because it allows you to multitask. Now, what's awesome about the Seabiscuit, An American Legend, unabridged version on audible.com, regularly it's priced at $35.93. And it is 13 hours and 13 minutes long, but you can get it for free. Again, all you have to do is go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter and sign up for Seabiscuit, An American Legend, or any book of your choice. Steve, thanks for the recommendation.
You're welcome.
Now, I'm sitting back. My feet are up on the desk. Let's start with our six main characters of Chasing Greatness, Johnny Miller, Arnold Palmer, and the miracle at Oakmont.
Well, perhaps if you don't mind, we'll start with Arnold Palmer. I'm in Western Pennsylvania. Adam and I met in Western Pennsylvania. And I can tell you for sure that for people in this part of the country and at Oakmont, when the U.S. Open came in 1973, it was all about Arnold Palmer. And Arnold Palmer seeking revenge against Jack Nicklaus for Nicklaus's defeat against him, in the 1962 U.S. Open in a playoff. Palmer had been thinking about it for years and years. He felt rejuvenated, even though he was 43 years old. He'd won a tournament earlier in the year. He was pretty confident he was going to compete in this tournament. He came back a month early to work with his dad, kind of revived his whole youth by coming back and working with his dad, who'd been his only teacher. Didn't bother to wear contact lenses or glasses as he'd been doing. He was young again. He was at Oakmont. He was on familiar turf, and he was out there to win. And frankly, I'd estimate from what we've read, 90% of the gallery in the 1973 U.S. Open followed Arnold Palmer from first round to last. And so that's where I'd like to start with one of our top characters.
Yeah, well, with Palmer, the other thing that I think is big at this point in his life and his career in 73, in June 73, is, you know, for all the great things Palmer did and all his championship heroics, you know, the comeback at Cherry Hills in 60 and the four Masters in 8 years, he hadn't won a major in 9 years when you get to Oakmont in 73. And he had only won one tournament. Like Steve said, he won the Bob Hope in February. He had been through the longest drought of his career from winning even a single tournament. He had gone 18 months or so without winning a tournament until he won in February. But he was also had been 9 years since he won even a major championship. And obviously, he never won another one even after 64. But when he comes to Oakmont, there's sort of a sense of, he's got to snap a streak, you know, like sort of like Tiger's going through now.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that parallel, how we forget about, you know, or maybe even not even known that Palmer went through such a drought as well.
Well, it wasn't. I mean, it's a drought that still continues if you think about it, because he was 35 when he won his last major, which was in 64 at Augusta. Hmm. And he had competed so many times. He'd come so close at especially at the U.S. Open, which, you know, he only won once, but he competed so often. He had such heartbreaks in 66 at Olympic, falling to Billy Casper in the back nine in a really the worst collapse in probably major championship history. And then the next year, he's right back in contention with Nicklaus at Baltusrol, and he shoots a 69 in the final round, which isn't good enough because Nicklaus shoots a 65. So he's got these back-to-back heartbreaks followed by a couple PGAs that he doesn't pull off in the end. So when you get to Oakmont in 1673, it's just this burden of major championship near misses. And, you know, as much as he wanted to beat Nicklaus or outdo Nicklaus for sort of stealing his thunder in 62 and show his hometown fans that he was still their king, he had a pretty big monkey on his back as far as becoming the championship hero that he had been a decade earlier.
And, you know, just I don't want to give away the story to your readers too much, but the story in 1973 is yet another heartbreak for Arnold Palmer. So very close, even thinking he's in the lead, not even able to imagine that Johnny Miller up ahead of him is shooting what will come to be known as the greatest round in championship golf history. But Palmer's collapse, as we tell it in Chasing Greatness, adds kind of the sadness component to the hero part of the book that we also make him out to be. So Palmer is very important to our story and to the history of Oakmont.
Well, I'd love to say that was a spoiler alert because it happened in 1973, I think we already knew that would happen.
The thing that I would add to that is, like you said, Palmer and the connection to Western Pennsylvania and that area. Palmer had grown up playing, not regularly, but he had played Oakmont as a kid when he was in high school. So he had a long-standing history. He had won an amateur tournament when he was in, 16 or 17 years old there. And it's sort of fitting that he has these two gigantic, golf tragic losses at Oakmont. And then you skip ahead, and this is mentioned later in the book, his U.S. Open farewell was at Oakmont in 1994, and he has a real emotional moment on the 18th green, and then in the press tent, and that's one of sort of the closing memories of Palmer at major championships is fittingly at Oakmont.
Now, in our remaining 10 minutes, I would like to, you've talked about there's six main characters in this book, and we've covered, how we're getting there. But let's see in the next 10 minutes if we can set up the next five main players of our story.
I think we can we'll save Miller for the end, I think, because he's probably who we want to finish with. But the early 70s is really like a golden era of golf. I mean, today doesn't compare to the stars who won and who competed. And we have these four other characters. I mean, obviously Jack Nicklaus is the paramount, and no one can compare to him. So, he has to be a figure just because he's there in the tournament. But then again, he shoots himself right into the lead, into the contention on the final day and steals a lot of the thunder early on. His great sort of a guy they thought was going to be his heir apparent was a guy who was also from Ohio, who lived in Columbus just like Nicklaus did, and who drove the ball just crazy long, was Tom Weisskopf, who by that time was 31, but had never been able to sort of step up to be the great player that a lot of people thought he was going to turn out to be the heir apparent to Nicklaus, and it just never happened. But in 73, he started to suggest that he was, because he had a fantastic run leading up to the Open. I think he won three or four tournaments. And he was really projected to be, this was his time. But ironically, the guy who really was Nicklaus's greatest challenger was Lee Trevino, who, is a pretty well-known character in the game's history. That point in the late 60s and early 70s, Nicklaus has said this, that Trevino was his greatest competitor. And this is a guy who stole the several tournaments, especially majors, the 71 Open at Marion. He beat him in a playoff. 72 British Open, he took the chance of the Grand Slam away from him. So Trevino is the guy who might be the most consistent and maybe arguably the best player of that late 60s, early 70s era. And all these guys, at one point or another, have highlights during those first 3 days and then are in contention a few strokes off near the back nine on the final Sunday. So I'll hand that over off to Steve before we get over to the big boy and Johnny Miller.
And Trevino, Palmer, and Nicklaus finished tied for fourth in the tournament. Tom Weisskopf finishes third. Finishing second is the true dark horse of the tournament, came within a few inches of defeating Miller, or tying Miller, rather, and that's John Schlee. And without going into detail, there's tragic elements to John Schlee's story. It's a very unique personal history for the game. And we uncovered a lot of details that no one had known about and explored. They're not always pleasant details about Mr. Schlee, but there was a rather heroic effort he made on the back nine to catch Johnny Miller, and we'll leave Schlee for the readers to probe later on.
But well, the one thing I would add about Schlee is this is a guy who was nobody really knew. Nobody still even really remembers. I mean, the true diehards remember him who followed the tour. But think about, he finishes one stroke off. The spoiler issue notwithstanding, he's a 40-foot chip that falls about 2 or 3 inches off from going in, away from pushing Miller into a playoff. for an 18-hole playoff the next day. And you think about the guys who have won U.S. Opens or majors, who that was the only thing they did, and we still know their names. Jack Fleck, Sam Parks, these guys, you know, they still have a special place in the game. And if that chip goes in and Schley beats Paul Miller the next day in a playoff, he's part of that collection of special people who won a major, and that was their you know, signature moment in a lifetime of 60, 70 years, whatever. So that's the sort of what-if interesting element at the end of the story with Schley, and sort of the, you know, one thing happens and his whole life is different. So that's sort of why he's an interesting figure amongst these sort of great, great, greats of all time.
And Schley said at the end, "I really wish I could have gotten in a playoff with a guy who shot 63. That is implying there's no way the guy would have anything left to come back the next day. But it didn't work out that way. The final character, and I guess we have only a few minutes left, is Johnny Miller. We explore his round of 63 in the greatest depth that anybody has ever been able to do. We had unique documentary sources, video sources, interview sources, and kind of put it all together. But what I think is most interesting for us about Miller is just how complex a character he is in golf history, what an innovator he has been in golf history, not only in the way he played the game, but in his broadcasting career starting in 1990. He's reinvented things in different parts of the game and is still a figure of real consequence. But what we found out about him was really kind of the two sides of Johnny Miller that we really hadn't been prepared for as we did our research. On the one hand, the very cocky, self-confident Miller, who just said, you know, I'm going to be the next great thing. There's no reason that I can't win a U.S. Open. I'm not afraid of anybody, on the one hand. And then on the other hand, a Johnny Miller who was often very negative in his self-assessments, despite his dad's child-rearing method, which was always to say, you know, emphasize the good, not the bad.
Power of positive thinking.
Power of positive thinking, Norman Vincent Peale type power of positive thinking way of upbringing. And by the way, he grew up in San Francisco. And had a chance to play San Francisco Golf Club, Olympic, all the great courses out there when he was growing up. And one of the things that our research confirmed overall was the truth of something that Jack Nicklaus told us in an interview that we did with him. And that was that, you know, Johnny, there were really just two sides to Johnny. He was either wholly positive or wholly negative. And both those elements form central parts of kind of the characterization of Johnny Miller that we do throughout Chasing Greatness. We think that we were able to bring not just the round of 63 and the other rounds he played to life, but to add layers of complexity to who Johnny Miller was and is that we think will really captivate the readers.
Yeah, and to expand on that, it's interesting to look at where Miller was at that point in his career in 73. He had burst on the scene. You know, he was a well-regarded amateur. He won the junior amateur in 64. But when he's a 19-year-old kid, he comes home from college from the summer, and the Open was at Olympic, and he was going to caddy, and he decided to try to qualify. He qualified. He goes out, and he plays with Nicklaus and shoots, has a fantastic one. He knows the course so well because he grew up playing it, and he finishes eighth. So people were thinking this 19-year-old kid is going to have just a dynamic career ahead of him. And he really doesn't have, you know, produce very much in those first few years on tour. He wins two tournaments. He has some well-known collapses, one at the Masters, one at Pebble Beach in the Bing Crosby. And he comes into 73 as a 26-year-old guy who hadn't really achieved that very much as a pro. You know, I kind of look at him a little bit the way that Sergio Garcia is today, that this is a guy who pushed Tiger Woods at the PGA when he was a teenager, and then still hasn't been able to pull off a major championship. And Miller, when he comes to Oakmont, is a guy who's in his mid to late 20s, and he's had some ups and downs, but he's never really, you know, made good on those promises of, oh, this guy's going to be the next big thing in golf. And it turns out to be the launching point of a really one of the greatest two or three-year runs in the history of the game that follow after he wins the U.S. Open in 73.
And, you know, we follow Miller through other parts of his career, too. And he had these ups and downs that may be traceable to the fact that ultimately he had a clear hierarchy in his life. Family and church were much more important to him than golf. He was he is a Mormon, a very devout one, and he really tries to balance things. Well, one of the things you do when you balance is you don't practice as much as you might otherwise do. And he's admitted he just didn't like practicing much. And so whatever failures might have preceded his winning the U.S. Open in 73 was followed by a great run, then dramatic decline, then great ups again, then downs again, ups again. And Miller ends up in 1994, 21 years after the 1973 U.S. Open, winning a major tour event at the age of 46. So these kind of up and down qualities to Miller's personality, to his game, his ability to go magically low, his ability to fall apart, all the parts of the kind of the complex character that we try to develop in Miller throughout the book.
That's the thing that stands out to me when we look at Miller and this up and down and everything. You've got a guy who shoots 76 in round three. Yep. And then comes back to 63 on the final day. He was just the master of being as high as, you know, high up in the as a kite one day and being down in the dumps the next day, or the other way around. And that's what happened at Oakmont. And that's, you know, I'm not sure, I'd have to go back and look, but I'm not sure that there's ever been a major championship, or especially a U.S. Open major championship winner, who had that kind of weekend. You know, you shoot a 76 and then you shoot a 63. 13 strokes in between is just crazy for a guy to pull away and win the U.S. Open that way.
And anybody who plays golf completely understands playing 2 days in a row with a 13-stroke difference.
Yeah, I can speak for myself.
Absolutely.
Triple digits might be in order there.
That's correct. Well, there's a phenomenal quote here about your book from David Fay, the executive director of the USGA, and he says that Chasing Greatness recreates one of the most memorable championships in golf history, the 1973 U.S. Open, and arguably the most heroic round ever played. Beautifully written and prodigiously researched, Chasing Greatness shows why golf history doesn't need fictionalization to produce compelling drama. Congratulations, gentlemen.
Yeah,
thank you. That is beautiful. All right, so your assignment class for next week is to first go to the Golfer's Mart at golfsmarter.com and buy the book, right? Chasing Greatness is available through Amazon, and we have that listed at the Golfer's Mart on our Golf Smarter page. And you can either buy the hardback, the paperback, or there is a Kindle version as well. So start reading this book, because on our next conversation, we are going to continue and hear in detail the setup of the four rounds and go into focus on that final round, the 63 that Johnny Miller shot. And yes, this is the same Johnny Miller that we're hearing as an analyst on TV all the time. If people aren't aware, that guy who's chattering all the time during the golf tournaments is the same Johnny Miller. And we're also going to have, I hope that that either Steve and or Adam are going to read parts of the book to us to give us some of the sense of how it sounds, how it reads, and give you a sense of an audiobook right there. So, gentlemen, are you prepared? We're gonna go on, and this could take quite a while. This could take upwards of an hour. Are you ready to do another episode with me?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Yes.
So, to our listeners, you need to know that if you want to hear part two of this compelling story, you need to become a member of Golf Smarter for members only. Join today. Go to golfsmarter.com. It's only $15 to get your six-month membership. And if you're in the United States or have a U.S. address or in the U.S. military, thank you, by the way, and you'd like to get a box of Dixon Wind balls, which are the long-distance balls, the only eco-friendly tournament-quality golf ball with the Golf Smarter logo, then it's only $35 to join. So please join Golf Smarter for members only today. And gentlemen, we will start part two in just a few moments. But for our listeners, stay tuned to next week. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's been a while since I've asked, but could you please post a review in iTunes about Golf Smarter? Word of mouth is the best advertising, and your honest comments could motivate a new listener to check us out. Thanks. If you have any questions or suggestions for me, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.